Well, good morning. I'd like to begin today by reading a scripture from Romans, the first chapter. Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 18. And even though the Apostle Paul here is addressing a situation that was occurring anciently, certainly pertains to the ancient world, it also has a message for us, and it is something in perhaps a different way, but is still going on today. Romans chapter 1, beginning in verse 18. Paul says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men, who by their wickedness suppress the truth." I'm reading from the Revised Standard Version. "For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them." Now, he's not talking about biblical revelation here. We have special revelation through the Bible that we regard as the Word of God. But Paul is talking about another means whereby God makes himself known. Not talking about knowledge of salvation, but a certain and definite knowledge of God can be known through a different means. And he tells us what that is in the next verses. He says, "For what could be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them." Verse 20, "Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." So what the Apostle Paul is saying here is that God reveals himself not only in Scripture, and not only did he reveal himself to the people of Israel at Mount Sinai in ancient times, but God from the very beginning has revealed himself to humankind in general through the things that are made. In other words, a human being with his God-given mind should be able to look at the heavens above and look at nature around him and see that there is a great designer behind the scenes, a God who brought these things into existence. And so Paul here is saying they are without excuse. He's not saying they're without excuse for their failure to understand salvation. That's a different issue. He's saying they are morally responsible, because knowledge of God leads to an awareness of morality and a personal responsibility. And so he says these people, even those, as he will say later, who have not received the law, and that's a great advantage. The Israelites received the law of God, certainly an advantage, but they went ahead and broke it too. But even those who have not received the law are morally responsible before God, because God has shown them his power and his divine nature in creation itself. Now, continuing, you'll notice that there's a pattern that begins to develop every time men begin to depart from a knowledge of God. Notice what it says in verse 21. "For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools, and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, or birds, or animals, or reptiles." And indeed, we see this throughout the world in ancient times, and as far as that goes today. And we even see it happening in ancient Israel. What did they do after seeing the glory of God displayed in the plagues that befell Egypt, and how God brought them out of that place with a mighty hand? What did they do as soon as they got in the wilderness and Moses was out of sight? They built something in the image of an animal and offered worship to that. And so this is the same thing he's talking about here. People do not retain God in their knowledge, even though God has revealed himself to them. And they begin to turn, and not only do they turn away from a knowledge of God, but when a knowledge of God leaves them, something else happens to them. And he tells us about that. He says, "Therefore God gave them up to the lusts," or gave them up in the lusts of their hearts, "to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." And you know, you will notice that when people abandon belief in God, the first thing that changes are attitudes about sex. That's a fact. And what the reason for that is that people begin to perceive that morality is merely, or how we define morality is entirely up to us. That there are no standards set for all mankind, that there's no universal standard. When you abandon God, you decide for yourself what is right and what is wrong. And so you see that a society, once it abandons God or belief in God, begins to plunge into the depths of immorality. And we won't read the entire thing, but Paul goes on to say how far it goes. It becomes perverse. He mentions homosexuality here, lesbianism. And it goes further and further. And finally, he sums it up by saying that these are full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity, and so on and so on. Read the entire chapter, and you can see that there's a pattern that happens when people abandon God. Now, Paul is talking about the idolaters of old here. And perhaps he has in mind some of the ancient philosophies, some of the things that some of the Greeks held, such as the idea that matter doesn't matter, you know, the stuff you're made out of doesn't matter, that all that matters is spirit. Of course, the Bible reveals that God made an abundance of matter. We could look around creation and see that, so matter does matter, no matter what you say, and that's a matter of fact. But Paul was speaking of these ancient, this ancient philosophy and this ancient, perhaps mysticism, the mythology that developed, idolatry that came about when men abandoned the worship of the Creator and looked to the things of creation. Now, in today's world, even though we do see some of the same things, by and large, in our enlightened, so-called enlightened society, we see the same thing happening, but in a different form. We see a philosophy that has invaded the institutions of higher learning in this country and around the world. It comes into our living rooms by way of the television set. It's in our textbooks. It seems that everything, every science, is based on it in some way. And I'm talking about a philosophy of evolution. And basically, that philosophy says that your life, my life, human life in general, everything that we are, our physiology, our anatomy, all that we see around us, is the result of a series of meaningless accidents. Meaningless accidents. You know, I was reading an article a while back about some evolutionist was glorifying Charles Darwin. You know who Charles Darwin is. He might be considered the father of evolutionary thought. He wrote Origin of Species, and he began the idea, or developed the idea, that everything began as a single-cell organism, and through random mutations gradually taking place down through the centuries, that this single-celled organism emerged into various forms until we have today everything from porcupines to elephants and shrubs and roses and musicians, and all of those things came from that single-cell organism. And so he promoted this idea. Someone said that an evolutionist listed some of the things that Charles Darwin contributed to society. And one of the things, interestingly enough, was the understanding that life is meaningless, that we give life its own meaning, that there is no grand purpose behind it all, that we're just here strictly by accident. We're the result of blind chance. And this is supposed to be a contribution. You know, it just happened. Somehow matter existed, and we don't know how. It just existed. And somehow it came together in just such a way as to accidentally form life. And one evolution says that life itself is a series of successful mistakes. And we'll talk about that a little later when we get into genetics. But this is a philosophy. It's a naturalistic philosophy, and it has the same effect as the ancient philosophy. Because many people today, and I will admit, there was a time when I was exposed to evolutionary thought that I struggled with agnosticism until I looked at the facts, and now I consider myself an incorrigible believer. I can't help but believe that there is a Creator God, and by the end of the sermon, I think you'll at least get a glimpse as to why I came to those conclusions. But I'd like to go through some points today about the facts of creation, and how that a creation does, in fact, demand a creator. I'd like to begin with the universe itself. Now, you know, you've been told that this is the result of a Big Bang. We don't know how this clump of matter became a clump of matter. You kind of start with that. And it became very compressed to the point, I guess, to the final extreme of compression, and then it blew apart. And now we have the universe formed. Now, we look at our sun, our Earth, what we know about the universe. We know that our sun is going to burn out someday, don't we? Think about that for a moment. Now, some scientists tell us it has not reached the fullness or the full brightness that it ultimately will reach. But we know that it will eventually become as bright as it's going to become, and then it'll start to fade. And over a period of time, it's going to burn out. You don't have to worry about that. You're going to be long gone. We're just assuming things will go on and the kingdom of God won't come. But you'll be long gone, as will your children and your children's children and their children for 1,000 and 10,000 generations. We're talking billions of years from now before the sun will burn out. But we know that it will. What does that tell you about the sun? If it's going to burn out, it must have begun to burn at some point, didn't it? Didn't it start somewhere? Of course it did. If it has a middle and an end, it must have a beginning. So it had to start somewhere. The same is true with our Earth. Our Earth, our planet, is revolving around the sun. We make the trip every year. It's a long trip, but we make it every year. All year long, we're traveling. We go around the sun. There must have been a first time when it made the trip. There will be a last time if things continue on going. And we know that every year we have an addition of times to add to the how many ever times went before. And that means it's the Earth has traveled around the sun a finite number of times, a number of times it can be numbered. Not infinite. Some think of things as going on infinitely. No, not infinite. We know that because we know the nature of material things. We also know that the Earth is rotating on an axis. We call it an axis. It's not really an axis, but, you know, there's a midpoint of rotation. It's rotating. Every day it does it. It goes all the way around. And we also know that it has rotated. Tomorrow it will have rotated one more time than it has rotated to this point today. In other words, there's a finite number of times. That means that the Earth began to rotate at some point in the past. Now, before the Earth rotated, the Earth existed in some form. It might have been matter strewn. Let's assume that the Big Bang Theory is correct. It might have been matter, just a lump of matter scattered out all over the place, and somehow it got drawn together and formed the Earth. But it was in some form, and the sun was some form before that. And you can look at every single process in this vast universe. And you have to come to the realization that in dealing with material things, every effect, everything you see is an effect of a previous cause. And every previous cause is itself the effect of a previous cause. And you could look at this whole, any process, if you could put it together as a chain of events, cause and effect events, eventually you would have to trace it back to a first link. That means that there had to be a first motion of matter. Matter is constantly moving. We know that the galaxies are moving. And I've got some news for you. You know you've heard about how the nearest galaxy, the Andromeda Galaxy, is 2.2 million light years away. That means if you had a starship that would go 186,000 miles per second, it would take you 2.2 million years to get there. That's a long way off. But someday we're not going to have to travel out there to get to another galaxy. Well, we're never going to make it that far anyway. But there's a galaxy headed right for us. It's going to clash with our galaxy. And it may be that someday planet Earth has itself a new sun it's revolving around. But there's a galaxy that's coming to us. We don't have to go out there and find out what's in the other galaxies. One of them, at least, is coming here. We're talking a few hundred billion years from now, of course. It's a long, long way off, but we know that it is on a path directly for us, and one day the galaxies will merge. Other galaxies have already done it. The point is, everything is in motion, and every motion is the result of a previous motion, which is the result of a previous motion, which is the result of a previous motion, and eventually you have to go back to the first motion. The motion of matter cannot be infinite. It had to start. Now, suppose everything was just one lump of matter, not moving, no motion. We see that's impossible because matter by its very nature is movement because it's energy. At the atomic level, there's movement going on. And even that must be the result of previous movement, which is the result of previous movement. In other words, to sum it all up, there can be no past eternity of matter. It means it had to come into existence at some point. And since matter cannot bring itself into existence, because then it would be preexistent and therefore eternal, it cannot bring itself into existence. There must of necessity have been a transcendent reality, something outside the material, a supernatural first cause that cannot be defined in terms of material measurements. We call that first cause God. So even if I look at everything from the point of view of the Big Bang of evolution, I don't say that I believe in the Big Bang. Of course, God could have started things that way if he so chose, but even if we look at it from that point of view, we still have to come to the conclusion that there must have been a first cause. For if the universe had been spread out before the Big Bang, and it had come together into one clump and then blown up again, and we have the oscillating universe where this keeps happening and happening and happening, there had to be a first time. So therefore, you have to have a first cause. And that first cause, by its very nature, must not be material, but must be outside the material realm, and therefore not measurable in material terms. Again, this is, as far as I'm concerned, is absolute proof that God exists. And you know, some of the ancient philosophers came to the same conclusions. Some of the philosophers, the Greek philosophers, came to the same conclusion, that there had to have been a first cause. Now, to move on to genetics and talk about our alleged descendancy from apes or from some simpler life forms. And do you ever wonder about, are you ever tempted to believe that maybe the human brain did actually evolve from a single cell organism millions of years ago that somehow came into existence in the sea due to elements just happened to swirl together, the right elements at the right time, and eventually this formed the human brain with its self-awareness? And now then the human brain can think about its own self, that is to say, it can think about the matter, that this matter would one day think about itself. In other words, this lifeless matter would one day form something that could think about itself and figure itself out. Well, if you do believe that, you have far more faith than I'll ever have. Far more. But neo-Darwinian evolutionists would have us believe that all living things evolved from a simple microbe that accidentally formed millions of years ago out in the sea and somehow managed to reproduce itself. You know, that's an amazing non-miracle in itself. Miracles don't happen, you know. It's an amazing thing. The fact that it even formed. Just suppose for a moment that something like that could have happened. Just the right elements somehow got together at just the right time and a living little blob formed. You would think that it wouldn't last very long, especially in such a hostile environment. But somehow it managed to survive. And not only survive, somehow it managed to reproduce itself. Boy, non-miracles of non-miracles. They never cease. So it manages to reproduce itself, and then somewhere along the way, these little things start to pick up additional information in the genetic blueprints. And as the genetic blueprints gain information, they form new creatures. Now let me pause here to explain something to you and try to put it in very simplistic terms. This is not the perfect analogy, but it'll work for our purposes today. Some of you older people may remember this strange-looking mechanism called a typewriter. Remember those? It's a funny-looking keyboard that doesn't even have a monitor hooked to it. Very strange thing. Some of you may remember those. Well, suppose that I have a document. Let's say it's a 10-page document, and my assignment is to make a copy of that document. We don't have a copying machine, so I have to type it. So I look at it, and I type. And keeping in mind we don't have the same spell check and all that stuff that we have today. And the correcting mistakes is by a wholly different, totally different mechanism than it is today when you're using a computer. So here I make a copy of this 10-page document. But we need many copies. So I keep the original, put it in my file, and then I take my copy and give it to the person next to me who then proceeds to make a copy. And then he keeps my copy, he takes his copy, passes the one he produced, passes it on to the next person, that person makes a copy. And you have this process going on. 5 people, 10 people, each person making a copy of a copy of a copy of a copy all the way back, you know. And say a year goes by, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and you still have this someone making a copy of a previous copy. Now then, at the end of, say, 20 years, you don't have to go that far, but let's say 20 years, you take the copy, the last copy that is made, and I pull out of my files the original, and you compare the two, what do you think you're going to find? Is it going to be the exact identical document? No, there will have been typos. And when the spell-checking devices came out and with the computers, I realized how many typos I had in my work at that point. How many things slip by without my knowledge, even though I checked it carefully? So there will be typos. Someone will have missed a line somewhere. Someone will have accidentally typed a correct word, but not the word in the document. And so you will have some bloopers, typos, in the end product. You will still have a lot of resemblance to the original, and the same message may get across, but there's going to be some differences there. Also, somebody along the way will probably notice that there's something missing, and he'll probably try to correct it himself. Say, well, I think what he meant was this, and so types in a correction. It's really not a correction at all. It's different information. Now, you may have noticed that you look like your parents. The reason for that is that they passed along a copy that was passed along to them. We call it the genetic blueprint. Is contained in the genes, in the cells of our body, the genetic blueprint that has the information on how to make a lung, how to make a heart, how to make all the systems of the body, and how to put it together in such a way that there you are. That's why you look like your parents, and your children look like you, and on down the way. Now, along the way, as this copying process continues, one generation gives a copy of the blueprint to the next generation containing all this information. Along the way, something happens. A typo, if you will, occurs. And what happens? A birth defect. Someone is born without a limb, or mental retardation sometimes occurs, or any number of things could happen. Very, very rarely does anything happen of a positive nature. In other words, the organism does not improve. If it does, it's extremely rare as a result of we call it a mutation. This is a genetic typo, a mutation. Now, according to Darwinian evolution, typos happen all the time in the process of passing on genetic information. Little typos. Little mutations, Charles Darwin described as very small mutations. But if you have very small mutations being handed across in the genetic information from generation to generation, as this material is copied and copied, the information is copied and copied and recopied, after a while, these little mutations will add up to big changes. So what do you have? You have the microbe becoming a kind of a fish-like creature. It develops fins. The ability to move through the water. Why? Because the water demands it? No. No. Strictly by chance. Pure chance. Pure. It just happens. It's a little typo. And the creatures that survive are those who develop organs and mechanisms that fit the environment. The environment doesn't force it, you understand. Doesn't force change. It just happens that certain creatures develop implements, organs, techniques, abilities, whatever, that enable them to survive. That's survival of the fittest. That's the concept that's behind that. You've heard of survival of the fittest. It's very important to evolutionary thinking. And so with all of this multiplication and buildup of mutations, over time, a lung develops. Over time, feathers develop in certain creatures. You know, flippers turn into legs, which turn into wings, which develop feathers. And all of these things happen as a result of tiny little mutations at the cellular level that's passed along to the next generation, and little additional mutations added to that until you have all these all these creatures emerging. So everything that's living, from roses to shrubs to earthworms to rattlesnakes to rhinoceroses and elephants and giraffes and human beings, all came from the same source and all developed as a result of these tiny little mutations. That is the theory of evolution. Now, we understand that there is such a thing as adaptation. We've seen it in nature. Adaptation does occur. But that's not Darwinian evolution. I'll explain that in a few moments. I'll tell you the difference. We do not see, and this is the thing, even though we do see adaptation, we do, and I'll explain this later, see survival of the fittest. We do see, to a certain extent, natural selection going on, and all of those elements are important to the theory of evolution. But we do not see, understand this, we do not see new information being added to the genetic blueprints of the creatures of this world. Now, automatically, somebody is going to object, and I received this objection recently by way of email. Someone read our booklet on evolution that Mr. Lloyd Carey wrote, Darren's father. And the person said, well, there were some good points in that booklet, but basically it was a bunch of garbage, a bunch of nonsense. And he goes on to explain how, in so many words, saying how educated people know that evolution happens. And he says, we can see it. It's happening right under our noses, literally, in the world of bacteria. Bacteria are evolving. Now, all of you have heard of the superbugs, haven't you? You've heard of how that we have introduced antibiotics into the environment. We get sick, have some kind of little organism in our bodies, a bacteria of some sort, a collection of bacteria. And we take the antibiotic, and it kills them. But not all of them. Some of them survive, and this person who gave me the email said, you see, this is evolution because the next generation is resistant to the antibiotic, and the bugs are evolving. They've become mutant bugs, X-bugs. Anybody see the X-Men? The whole idea is these new mutants that emerged. All the way back to the 60s, I was familiar with the X-Men. I have some of the older comic books, some of the Marvel comic books when they first came out with the X-Men. I remember when they came on the scene. Of course, they evolved, no pun intended, over the years and now have a lot of different characters. And now they're in the movies. The X-Men, these are mutants. And what happened, new information somehow got into the genetic blueprints of their parents and showed up in these children. One of them has beams blasting out of his eyes and can knock holes in the wall with his eye beams. Another can cause his environment around him to freeze. He's called Iceman. Another had wings grow out of his back. Because of this genetic blooper, you know, a typo on the genetic level. And so the idea here, as it said, if you saw the advertisement for the movies, or if you saw the first movie, Professor Xavier said, mankind is evolving. And the idea is that new information is being added at the genetic level. And some people say, well, this is really happening. These little critters we call bacteria, they are evolving. And now we have super bugs to deal with. Let me tell you the truth about that. We do not have evolving super bugs. Yeah, we have some stronger bacteria, but the genetic information in these strong bacteria already existed in previous generations. And you know what? There was a group of explorers who died. They froze to death. And much later, somebody came along and found those explorers and brought them back. They did autopsies. And they took bacteria out of their intestines and revived the bacteria. And they found that bacteria to be resistant to powerful antibiotics, even though those explorers died before those antibiotics were developed. Superbugs already in existence. So the superbugs we see today, so-called superbugs, did not have anything added to the genetic blueprints. It was already there. Let me tell you what happens and why we have superbugs. Actually, two or three different things can happen to produce these so-called superbugs, and some of them are not superbugs at all. Let's suppose you're in the hospital, and you have about 5 million of these little critters crawling around inside your body making you sick. and they give you an antibiotic, and that antibiotic kills all of them except for 10. You have only 10 of them left now. Under normal circumstances, your body's own immune systems would clean up the remainder. But in some cases, they survive. Why did they survive? Why did those 10 survive? For the same reason that if you had a room full of people, let's say all in the same family, 10 brothers, and you put some kind of poison into their food, and they all got a bunch of the poison, and 8 of them died and 2 lived. It's just because that 2 happened to be stronger and were able to resist the poison. Similarly, some of the bugs are able to resist the poison, the antibiotic. Not because they have developed new information in the genetic on the genetic level, but because of existing information. It was already there. They just got a bigger dose of it, a bigger amount of that which made them strong, and whatever terms you want to put it in. Okay, so they survive. And what happens? They multiply. And their offspring, the bugs that come from them, will have their characteristics. So what you're doing in producing superbugs, you're not adding something to the environment that will cause them to add new information to the genetic blueprints. You're actually eliminating information from the genetic blueprints, thus resulting in stronger bugs. You're taking away that in their genetic codes that causes them to be susceptible to certain types of antibiotics. It's the opposite of what evolution would have you believe. You're removing information, not adding information, by killing off a large segment of the population. It's just like if you had, say, suppose you had 10 brothers, and 9 of them were 5 feet 7 to 5 feet 8 inches tall. The 10th one was 6 feet 9. Does that ever happen? Once in a while, not because new information was added to the genetic blueprints of the parents. It was already there. It just showed up in this one person. Now, of course, if you wiped out the short people, you started killing off all the short people and keeping only the people that were 6 feet tall or more, then eventually you would have a taller population. Not due to adding more information, but due to eliminating information from the genetic pool. That's not evolution. Now, you could call it evolution, but it's not the creation of anything, not the addition of something, it's the elimination of something already there. And that's what we see going on in the world of so-called superbugs. Now, there's another way in which these so-called superbugs develop. Suppose, again, you're in the hospital. You got a million of these little critters crawling around in there. And the reason they make you sick is that, you see, they live in your bodily fluids. And that's where the nourishment is. And they have very elaborate little and efficient pumps in their bodies. And they're able to pump in your bodily fluids and take in the nutrients that enable them to survive and to multiply. And, of course, the waste matter that is produced is toxic, and it makes you sick. Okay, suppose, once again, you're in a hospital, an antibiotic is introduced, and you kill off most of the population. Except, in this case, you have a few, say 10 remaining, who happen to be mutants. Yeah, mutants. There was a genetic typo that happened at the time that they came into existence, and so they're mutants. But are they super mutants like the X-Men? Are they X-critters? No, you see, they're weaker than the others. Now, how can the weak survive? I thought it was survival of the fittest. How can the weaker survive? Well, in this case, you see, a mutation caused them not to be able to have efficient pumps in their bodies. In other words, just as some people are born with physical handicaps, these little critters were born or hatched out or however they come into existence with a handicap. Their food pumps didn't work very well. Enough that they could survive, enough that they could multiply, they could take in a certain amount of nutrient, but not enough. You know, not enough to be healthy. So they're unhealthy bugs. But by the same token, they can't take in the penicillin that you just put in there or the other antibiotic. They can't pump it in, and thus they can't die. So their defect protects them. It's like the guy who can't swallow. Try to give him a poison pill, it's not going to do anything. He can't swallow it. He has a defect. The person who's healthy and can swallow real well can take a horse pill, and it's going to kill him. Same thing with these little bugs. So it's not super bugs. They're sick bugs. They're very sick. Now, as long as you're in the hospital, because you continue to take the antibiotics and you're in a very sterile environment, you notice that you stay sick. That's because these bugs keep on living. The antibiotics are not killing them. They can't pump in the poison that would kill them and that did kill all their healthy counterparts or their healthy brothers. So it doesn't work. You stay in the hospital, you stay sick. The doctor says, get out of the hospital. Go out, roll in the dirt a little bit, sweat, get out in the open air, breathe in some pollen and all the things that normally make you sick. He gets out there and does that, and lo and behold, 2 weeks, you're well. You know why? Because you've gotten out there in the atmosphere or in nature, and you're drawing in with your breath and in the pollen and the dust in the air, you're taking in some more germs. And you're playing out there and got all sweaty and you fall down, get dirt, you get more, you get a little cut, get some more germs in there. And after a while, your body, and right now you have them all in your body, you know that, don't you? Not a very pleasant thing to think about, but we have these little organisms there. You see, those sick bugs that we thought were super bugs eat, and so they die, and you get well. This is not evolution taking place. It's the opposite. It's not creatures becoming greater and adding new information to the genetic codes and developing new systems as a result of new information. In these cases, we have sometimes mutations resulting in an inferior bug who's able to live in antibiotics. And in some cases, you have strong bugs that are not able to live, but stronger bugs, not due to new information, but simply old information already there, who are able to survive. Now, you may have also noticed that, I'll give you another example. Some have pointed to the fact that there are beetles. You've all seen beetles, winged beetles of various sorts. In the continental United States, there's a certain type of beetle, a winged beetle, that's all over the place. There's the same species is found on an island, only that one doesn't have wings. And some say, well, this is here you see evolution taking place. Let me tell you what happened in that case. You might think, well, you got winged beetles, the same type of beetle, some that don't have wings, maybe they evolved wings. No, you see, what happened is they had wings. They made their way to that island somehow. Either they were carried there, people traveling back and forth or whatever, or they flew there somehow. Maybe the wind carried them. They got to the island. When they got there, there was a birth defect that took place, a mutation, and a generation of bugs were born that didn't have wings, just as there are some people who are born that don't have some properly functioning bodily organ, or maybe a limb is missing or something like that, a finger or whatever. Well, these bugs came along, hatched out, and didn't have wings. So you might say, would you consider that a superior mutation? No, not at all. It lost its wings. It can't fly. Now then, the thing about it is, though, is that the winds get very high out there on that island. And when the winds start getting up, and the bugs are hanging on, and they're bouncing back and forth on the weeds and whatever they're hanging on to, naturally, if they can fly, they fly. And then what do? They blow them out to sea, and they never make it back to the island, and they wind up in the bellies of fish. And the only bugs that remain are those who cannot fly. So you have an island out there that has that species, the same species, that can fly here but can't fly there. That's not new information being added at the genetic level. It's a loss of information. And we could go on and on. The blind fish that live in areas where there's no sunlight, the reason they live is because they wouldn't live elsewhere. There are fish that are born or hatch out or however they get here, that come into this world blind because they have a genetic defect. And guess what happens to them? big fish comes along. They can't see them. Now, when they're born way down there in a dark cave where there is no sunlight and they don't have the same predatory problem, then they survive and they flourish. But again, you're not seeing evolution happening, not in the Darwinian sense. You are seeing adaptation. You are seeing survival of the, should you call those the fittest? I guess those fittest for that particular environment. But you do not see Darwinian evolution where new information is being added to the genetic blueprint. Now, I have a couple of mutants in my home, and some of you have mutants as well. My little mutant wolves. One of them's named Coconut, the other's named Raisin. Actually, they're little dogs, but, you know, their forefathers, their forebears were wolves. And people say, well, isn't that evolution? Well, think about it for a moment. Everything my dogs have were present in the wolves aboard the ark. Some people think, how did Noah get all those animals? You had to have chihuahuas and poodles and Great Danes. And no, just a pair of wolves will do it. Big old timber wolves, I suppose. And the genetic information is all contained in that pair. What happens then with what happened to my little dogs, my little mutants, is that they began to lose information along the way. They began to lose, either that or they were paired with others of the same genetic structure, and one side of the genetic pool diminished as another increased. There was some shifting going on in the genetic pool, in other words. But no new information added. You see, my dogs, some dogs still have snouts just like a timber wolf. But they get shorter and shorter and shorter until some of them look like they've been run into a wall at full speed. That's because something was lost from the genetic blueprint. Have little dogs about that long, with legs about that long? Like Benny has one like that. Well, his forebears had long legs, but Lucy lost something along the way. And that's the blueprint required to have long legs. They got shorter and shorter. And, of course, we can breed dogs, and we see this happening, and sometimes you can get what you're doing, you're thinning the genetics. You're thinning them out genetically. And you can actually get a dog, say a thin-snouted dog, make that snout eventually get so thin it can hardly breathe, which is not a good thing. But that's not gain. You're not adding something to the genetic pool. You're taking something. You're shifting around or taking away. It's as simple as that. So, yeah, there are mutants. I have little mutants at my home. Some of you have mutant dogs or mutant wolves. We see mutants in the environment, but we do not see mutations bringing about superior creatures that have information in the genetic code that their predecessors did not have. It's not happening. In other words, didn't come a time, from anything we can see, there did not come a time when some kind of gilled creature, who somehow evolved gills, developed information or gained information through a series of mistakes that gave it lungs. There's nothing that we see in the life sciences to indicate that any such thing ever happened. Adaptations, yes. Changes in the species, yes. But transition from one species to another with these massive changes and this massive influx and gain, net gain of information at the genetic level? No. No. Darwinism is a fraud. It's a fraud. It didn't happen. I want to have a few quotations here I'd like to read from various scientists. One is from a famous French biologist named Pierre Grasset. In his book entitled Evolution of Living Organisms, he says, he's talking about the mutation of bacteria. He says, mutations do not produce any kind of evolution. Dr. Lee Spetner, who is a scientist, he taught information and communication at Johns Hopkins University, wrote a book entitled Not by Chance, says, in all the reading I've done in the life sciences literature, I've never found a mutation that added information. He also says all point mutations that have been studied on the molecular level turn out to reduce the genetic information and not to increase it. So if you're going to have a creature developing a lung, you have to have an increase. You don't see that happening. Dr. Michael Behe, well, let's skip over what he says. Let's get on over to Dr. Werner Gitt, who authored a book entitled In the Beginning Was Information. And he's a director and professor at the German Federal Institute of Physics and Technology. He says it should be emphasized that matter as such is unable to generate any code. All experiences indicate that a thinking being voluntarily exercising his own free will, cognition, and creativity is required. He says also in the same book, there is no known natural law through which matter can give rise to information. Neither is any physical process or material phenomenon known that can do this. In other words, we don't see any reason to believe that somehow the matter in this universe swirled together in such a way as to form a genetic pool. Didn't happen. And as I said earlier, if you believe that, then you've got yourself some kind of faith there. I have to hand it to you. Call me a skeptic. I can't muster that kind of faith to believe such a thing. Now, I'd like to move up, and with all of this in mind, I'd like you to think for a moment about some of the organs of the human body. Think about the eye, the human eye. One evolutionist said it looks more like the work of a tinkerer than somebody really knew what he's doing. I thought, what kind of idiotic fool could make such a statement? What you need to do the next time you go to the eye doctor, or if you have a computer and you like to look at websites, look it up. Just put human eye in google.com and find out what it says. You'll find illustrations showing you the various components of the human eye. You have the lenses, you have the rods and cones and all of that stuff. It'll show you how images are projected and how they're received into the eye and then projected. And somehow, you see, what I'm seeing here, I don't really see you. I see light reflecting off of you. And it's putting an image in my head here. This is a sensory mechanism, and I'm able even to determine how far away you are. I have this depth perception ability. It's built in. And the amount of light that's in the room, you increase the light, and my eyes have this little component. There's a component of the eye that allows it to adjust to the amount of light. Decrease the light, and it will adjust. It opens and closes to a certain degree, allowing X amount of light in so that the image can be projected and I can make use of this sensory mechanism and know where you are. Now, in addition to that, you will notice that my eyes are in sockets. That means that they can move about. But they don't just move randomly. They have this contractile material attached to them. We call it muscles. In just the right places so that I can move my eyes from one point to the other and my point of focus changes. I can look at Roy back there, and just by moving my eyes, sending an impulse from my brain to the muscles in my eyes, connected to my eyes, and move my eyes to focus on Benny over there. It's amazing. A tinkerer? Give me a break. The fact that it can adjust, that it can focus, that it gives me depth perception. An image is actually projected, and I know what's in my environment. And then it moves about, and guess what? They're not located on my kneecaps. Otherwise, I'd have to be standing up here looking at you like that. I have to pull up my pants leg. They're not located on my back, on my shoulder blades. They're not located on my elbow. They're right here where they need to be, right at the top of the organism. And not only do my eyes turn and focus, but I've got, look, one of these, a head that turns. It looks up, down, it can aim in every direction. It gives me even a greater range. And not only do I turn my eyes, I turn my head. Amazing. What you're looking at here is a creative masterpiece. Yeah, okay. No, you think about it. And you ask me to believe. Would you ask me to believe that this is a result of little mutations from a single-celled organism down across the centuries that just randomly happened and all by mistake? That this is a result of a series of successful mistakes. Again, you have more faith than I do if you believe that. Now, not only do I have these marvelous little sensory mechanisms called eyes, and not only are they located in just the right place and they can do things that enable me to make maximum use of them, but they work in unison with these four other sensory mechanisms. I can hear. Not only do I gain information by reflections from light, also the vibrations that you're out there making come across in the air, and I can pick them up. And I can make sense of them in some cases. I can discern the meaning of those. You know, we have these vocal cords here, and we can make them vibrate. That's what I'm doing right now. And I can, with air coming across and the vibrating vocal cords, and I can move my lips and my tongue and my mouth in just such a way as to form particular sounds. And we, because of the intelligence that we have, are able to attach meanings to those sounds. And so, therefore, I can articulate. I can make vibrating air molecules make you know what I'm thinking. It's amazing, isn't it? The idea just happened by chance. Just a meaningless accident that we got lucky, I guess you could say, in the evolutionary scale of things. And we could go on and on and on. We could talk about the digestive system, the endocrine system, the central nervous system with the brain, and just absolutely amazing. The reproductive system, all the systems of the body, and they work in unison as a unit. And to think, this idea that this happened as a result of little random mutations along the way is beyond anything that I'm able to even begin to grasp. I have to take the simple way out. Say there must be something outside the material realm that caused it all to be. And when I look at the nature of things, when I consider the complexity of the human brain, the fact that I am self-aware, that's another thing. How can matter know about itself? Just pure matter, you know, does matter give rise to thought? But I am self-aware, and I can communicate with other beings like myself who are also self-aware. And that this happened by chance, by blind chance, by successful mistakes happening in the swirling of matter? Give me a break. No, there's only one solution, and that is God created the heavens and the earth. God made man and put him on this earth and gave him the capacities. That's the only solution. And I know that all people here, you might think, well, you're preaching to the choir. We all believe in God. I know you do. We all do. But because we have this philosophy that's out there and is affecting things, and you see it affecting people who do believe in God, I think it's good that we take a look at it from time to time and realize that it's a false philosophy. It's founded on false. It has a false premise. And at the end of the day, we have to realize, even though we may not be able to understand God completely, we may not understand why He permits certain things to happen. You know, some atheists use the argument that they're very fond of this argument. They say, if God is good, if there is a good God and He's omniscient and omnipotent and all that, then why does He allow so much evil? So therefore, the conclusion is that there must not be a God. You know, they're starting on page 10. You ask those questions later. First, you look at causation and determine that there must be a God. Then you can wonder about His nature and why He allows things. But first, let's start with the fact. And the fact is, as we look at the natural world, as we look at this universe and all its complexity, and the human body and all its complexity, and all the life forms, we have to conclude that we see intelligent design, not the end result of a long series of genetic bloopers. God exists.